Mallory stared at the glowering ranks of numbered scapegraces, many of them with disquietingly misshapen heads. He remembered the tout's face with great clarity. He remembered it twisted with homicidal rage, bloody spittle in the cracked teeth. The sight was etched forever in his mind's eye, as vivid as the knuckle shapes of the beast's spine when first he'd seen his great prize jutting from the Wyoming shale. In one long, dawning moment, then, Mallory had seen through those drab stone lumps and perceived the imminent glow of his own great glory, his coming fame. In just such a manner he had seen in the tout's face a lethal challenge that could transform his life. But none of these dazed and sullen portraits matched the memory. Is there any reason why you wouldn't have this man? Perhaps your man has no criminal record, Tobias said. We could run the card again to check against the general population, but that would take us weeks of engine spinning and require a special clearance from the people upstairs. Why so long, pray? Dr. Mallory, we have everyone in Britain in our records, everyone who's ever applied for work or paid taxes or been arrested. Tobias was apologetic, painfully eager to help. Is he a foreigner, perhaps? I'm certain he was British and a blackguard. He was armed and dangerous, but I simply don't see him here. Perhaps it is a bad likeness, sir. Your criminal classes, they like to puff out their cheeks for criminal photography, wads of cotton up their noses and such like tricks. I'm sure he's there, sir. I don't believe it. Is there another possibility? Tobias sat down, defeated. That's all we have, sir, unless you want to change your description. Might someone have removed his portrait? Tobias looked shocked. That would be tampering with official files, sir. A felony transportation offence. I'm sure none of the clerks would have done such a thing. There was a heavy pause. However, Mallory urged. Well, the files are sacrosanct, sir. It is what we're all about here, as you know. But there are certain highly placed officials from outside the Bureau, men who serve the confidential safety of the realm, if you know the gents I mean. I don't believe I do, Mallory said. A very few gentlemen in positions of great trust and discretion, Tobias said. He glanced at the other men in the room and lowered his voice. Perhaps you've heard of what they call the Special Cabinet, or the Special Bureau of the Bow Street Police. Anyone else? Mallory said. Well, the royal family, of course. We are servants of the crown here, after all. If Albert himself were to command our Minister of Statistics, what about the Prime Minister, Lord Byron? Tobias made no reply. His face had soured. An idle question, Mallory said. Forget I asked it. It's a scholar's habit, you see. When a topic interests me, I explore its specifics, even to the point of pedantry. But it has no relevance here. Mallory peered at the pictures again with a show of close attention. No doubt it is my own fault. The light here is not all it might be. Let me turn up the gas, the boy said, half rising. No, Mallory said. Let me save my attention for the woman. Perhaps we'll have better luck there. Tobias sank back in his seat. As they awaited the engine spin, Mallory feigned a relaxed indifference. Slow work, eh, Mr. Tobias? A lad of your intelligence must long for a greater challenge. I do love engines, Tobias said. Not these great lummox monsters, but the cleverer, aesthetic ones. I wanted to learn clacking. Why aren't you in school, then? Can't afford it, sir. The family doesn't approve. Did you try the national merit exams? No scholarship for me. I failed the calculus. Tobias looked sullen. I'm no scientist, anyway. It's art that I live for. Kinotropy. Theatre work, eh? They say it's in the blood. I spend every spare shilling on spinning time, the boy said. We have a little club of enthusiasts. The Palladium rents its kinotrope to us during the wee hours. You see quite amazing things sometimes, along with a deal of amateur drivel. Fascinating, Mallory said. I hear that, he had a struggle to recall the man's name. I hear that John Keats is quite good. He's old, the boy said with a ruthless shrug. You should see Sands, or Hughes, or Etty. And there's a clacker from Manchester whose work is quite splendid, Michael Radley. I saw a show of his here in London last winter, a lecture tour with an American. Kinotrope lectures can be very improving. Oh, the speaker was a crooked Yankee politician. If I had my way, they'd throw the speaker out entirely and run silent pictures. Mallory let the conversation lapse. Tobias squirmed a bit, wanting to speak again and not quite daring to take that liberty. And then the bell rang. The boy was up like a shot, with a scratchy skid of his worthless shoes, and back with another set of fanfold paper. "Redheads," he said, and smiled sheepishly. Mallory grunted. He studied the women with close attention. They were fallen women, ruined women, with a sodden look of fall and ruin marked indelibly in the little black picture bits of their printed femininity. Unlike the men, the female faces somehow leapt to life for Mallory. Here a round-faced, cockney creature with a look more savage than a Cheyenne squaw. There a sweet-eyed Irish girl whose lantern jaw had surely embittered her life. There a streetwalker with rat's nest hair and the blear of gin. There defiance. Here tight-lipped insolence. There a frozen cajoling look from an English woman with her nape pinched for too long in the daguerreotype's neck brace. The eyes, with their calculated plea of injured innocence, held him with a shock of recognition. Mallory tapped the paper, looking up. "Here she is." Tobias started. "That's rum, sir. Let me take that number." He punched the citizen number into a fresh card with a small mahogany switch press, then fed the card through the wall tray again. He carefully emptied the bits of punched-out paper into a hinge-topped basket. "This will tell me all about her, will it?" Mallory said. He reached inside his jacket for his notebook. "Mostly, sir. A printed summary. And may I take these documents away with me for study?" "No, sir, strictly speaking, as you're not an officer of the law." Tobias lowered his voice. "Truth to tell, sir, you could pay a common magistrate or even his clerk and have this intelligence for a few shillings under the rose. Once you've someone's number, the rest is simple enough. It's a common clacker trick to read the engine files on someone of the criminal class. They call it pulling his string, or being up on a cake." Mallory found this news of remarkable interest. "Suppose I ask for my own file," he said. "Well, sir, you're a gentleman, not a criminal. You're not in the common police files. Your magistrates and court clerks and such would have to fill out forms and show good cause for the search, which we don't grant easily." "Legal protocols, eh?" Mallory said. "No, sir. It's no law that stops us, but the simple trouble of it. Such a search consumes engine time and money, and we're always over budget in both. But if an MP made that request, or a lordship..." "Suppose I had a good friend here in the Bureau," Mallory said. "Someone who admired me for my generous ways." Tobias looked reluctant and a bit coy. "It ain't a simple matter, sir. Every spinning run is registered, and each request must have a sponsor. What we did today is done in Mr. Wakefield's name, so there'll be no trouble in that. But your friend would have to forge some sponsor's name and run the risk of that imposture. It is fraud, sir. An engine fraud like credit theft or stock fraud, and punished just the same when it's found out." "Very enlightening," Mallory said. "I found that one always profits by talking to a technical man who truly knows his business. Let me give you my card." Mallory extracted one of his Morland Polyblank cartes de visite from his pocketbook. Folding a £5 note, he pinched it against the back of his card and passed it over. It was a handsome sum. A deliberate investment. Tobias dug about beneath his apron, found a greasy leather wallet stuffed in Mallory's card and money, and extracted a dog-eared bit of shiny pasteboard. J.J. Tobias, Esquire, the card said, in grotesquely elaborate engine gothic. Kinotropy and Theatre Collectibles. There was a Whitechapel address. "Never mind that telegraph number at the bottom," Tobias told him. "I had to stop renting it." "Have you any interest in French kinotropy, Mr. Tobias?" Mallory said. "Oh, yes, sir," nodded Tobias. "Some lovely material is coming out of Montmartre these days." "I understand the best French ordinateurs employ a special gauge of card." "The Napoleon gauge," Tobias said readily. "Smaller cards of an artificial substance, which move very swiftly in the compilers. That speed is quite handy in kino work." "Do you know where a fellow might rent one of these French compilers?" "Here in London?" "To translate data from French cards, sir?" "Yes," Mallory said, feigning an only casual interest. "I expect to receive some data from a French colleague, involving a scientific controversy. Rather abstruse, but still a matter of some scholarly confidentiality. I prefer to examine it privately at my own convenience." "Yes, sir," Tobias said. "That is to say, I do know a fellow with a French compiler, and he'd let you do whatever you like with it, if the pay were right. Last year there was quite a mode in London clacking circles for the French standard, but sentiment has turned quite against it, what with the troubles of the Grand Napoleon." "Really?" Mallory said. Tobias nodded, delighted to show his authority. "I believe it's felt now, sir, that the French were far ahead of themselves with their vast Napoleon project, and made something of a technical misstep. Mallory stroked his beard. "That wouldn't be British professional envy talking, I hope?"
"Not at all, sir. It's common knowledge that the Grand Napoleon suffered some dire mishap early this year," Tobias assured him, "and the great engine has never spun quite properly since."
He lowered his voice.
"Some claim sabotage." "Do you know that French term, sabotage? Comes from sabot, the wooden shoes worn by French workers. They can kick an engine half off its blocks."
Tobias grinned at this prospect with a glee that rather disquieted Mallory.
"The French have Luddite troubles of a sort, you see, sir, much as we once did, years ago."
Two short notes were sounded on a steam whistle, reverberating through the whitewashed ceiling. The two studious gentlemen, who had been joined by an equally studious third, now closed their albums and left. The bell rang once more, summoning Tobias to the wall tray. The boy rose slowly, straightened a chair, wandered down the length of the table, examined the albums for non-existent dust, and shelved them.
"I think that's our answer waiting," Mallory said.
Tobias nodded shortly, his back to Mallory.
"Very likely, sir, but I'm on overtime, see. Those two blasts on the horn."
Mallory rose impatiently and strode to the tray.
"No, no," Tobias yelled. "Not without gloves. Pray let me do it."
"Gloves, indeed. Who's to know?
Criminal anthropometry, that's who. This is their room, and nothing they hate worse than the smudges from bare fingers."
Tobias turned with a sheaf of documents.
"Well, sir, our suspect is one Florence Bartlett, nay Russell, late of Liverpool."
"Thank you, Tobias," Mallory said, creasing the sheaf of fanfold so as to slip it more easily into his Ada-checkered waistcoat.
"I do appreciate your help."
One Arctic Wyoming morning, the frost thick on the brown and beaten prairie grass, Mallory had crouched beside the tepid boiler of the expedition's steam fortress, prodding at its meagre buffalo-dung fire, trying to thaw an iron-hard strip of the jerked beef that the men ate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. At that moment of utter misery, his beard rimed with frozen breath and his shovel-blistered fingers frost-bitten, Mallory had sworn a solemn oath that he would never again curse the summer heat. But never had he expected so vile a swelter in London. The night had passed without a breath of wind, and his bed had seemed a fetid stew. He'd slept atop the sheets, a drenched Turkish towel spread across his nakedness, and had risen every hour to dampen the towel again. Now the mattress was soaked, and the whole room seemed as hot and close as a greenhouse. It stank of stale tobacco as well, for Mallory had smoked half a dozen of his fine Havanas over the criminal record of Florence Russell Bartlett, which dealt primarily with the murder of her husband, a prominent Liverpool cotton merchant, in the spring of 1853. The modus operandi had been poisoning by arsenic, which Mrs. Bartlett had extracted from flypaper and administered over a period of weeks in a patent medicine, Dr. Gove's Hydropathic Strengthener. Mallory, from his nights down Haymarket, knew that Dr. Gove's was, in fact, a patent aphrodisiac, but the file made no mention of this fact. The fatal illness in 1852 of Bartlett's mother and of her husband's brother in 1851 were also recorded, their respective certificates of death citing perforated ulcer and cholera morbus. These purported illnesses featured symptoms very like those of arsenic poisoning. Never formally accused of these other deaths, Mrs. Bartlett had escaped custody, overpowering her jailer with a concealed derringer. The Central Statistics Bureau suspected her of having fled to France, Mallory assumed, because someone had appended translations of French police reports of 1854 dealing with a crime passionnel trial in the Paris Assizes. One Florence Murphy, abortionist, purportedly an American refugee, was arrested and tried for the crime of vitriolage, the flinging of sulfuric acid with intent to disfigure or maim. The victim, Marie Lemoine, wife of a prominent Lyon silk merchant, was an apparent rival. But Mrs. Murphy had vanished from custody, and from all subsequent French police records during the first week of her trial as a vitrioleuse. Mallory sponged his face, neck, and armpits in tap water, thinking bleakly of vitriol. He was perspiring freely again as he laced his shoes. Leaving his room, he discovered that the city's queer summer had overwhelmed the palace. Sullen humidity simmered over the marble floors like an invisible swamp. The very palms at the foot of the stairs seemed Jurassic.
He trudged to the palace's dining room, where four cold, hard-boiled eggs, iced coffee, a kippered herring, some broiled tomato, a bit of ham, and a chilled melon somewhat restored him. The food here was rather good, though the kipper had smelled a bit off. Small wonder in heat like this. Mallory signed to the chit and left to fetch his mail. He had been unjust to the kipper. Outside the dining room, the palace itself stank. Bad fish, or something much like it. There was a soapy perfume in the front lobby left from the morning's mopping, but the air was heavy with the humid, distant reek of something dreadful, and apparently long dead. Mallory knew he had smelled that reek before. It was sharp, like acid, mixed with the greasy stench of a slaughterhouse, but he could not place the memory. In a moment the stink was gone again. He stepped to the desk for his mail. The wilted clerk greeted him with a show of courtesy. Mallory had won the staff's loyalty with generous tips. "Nothing in my box," said Mallory, surprised. "Too small, Dr. Mallory." The clerk bent to lift a large, woven wire basket, crammed to the brim with envelopes, magazines, and packages. "Struth," Mallory said. "It gets worse every day." The clerk nodded knowingly. "The price of fame, sir." Mallory was overwhelmed. "I suppose I shall have to read through all of this." "If I may be so bold, sir, I think you might do well to engage a private secretary." Mallory grunted. He had a loathing of secretaries, valets, butlers, chambermaids, the whole squalid business of service. His own mother had been in service once, with a wealthy family in Sussex, in the old days before the Rads. The fact rankled. He carried the heavy basket into a quiet corner of the library and began to sort through it. Magazines first. The gold-spined Transactions of the Royal Society, Herpetology of All Nations, Journal of Dynamical Systematics, Annales scientifiques de l'école des ordinateurs, with what seemed to be an interesting article on the mechanical miseries of the Grand Napoleon. This business of the scholarly subscriptions had been a faggot above a load, though he supposed it kept the editors happy, happy editors being half the key to placing one's own articles. Then the letters. Swiftly, Mallory divided them into piles, begging letters first. He had made the mistake of answering a few that had seemed especially tearful and sincere, and now the scheming rascals had swarmed upon him like lice. A second pile of business letters, invitations to speak, requests for interviews, bills from shopmen, catastrophist bone men and rockhounds offering co-authorship of learned papers. Then the letters in feminine hand, the broody hens of natural history, flower snippers, Huxley called them. They wrote in their scores and dozens, most merely to request his autograph, and, if he so pleased, a signed carte de visite. Others would send him coy sketches of common lizards requesting his expertise in reptile taxonomy. Others would express a delicate admiration, perhaps accompanied with verses, and invite him to tea if he was ever in Sheffield, or Nottingham, or Brighton. And some few, often marked by spiky handwriting, triple underlining, and ribboned locks of hair, would express a warm, womanly admiration, and this in terms so bold as to be quite disconcerting. There had been a remarkable flurry of these after his fancy portrait had appeared in the English Woman's Domestic Weekly. Mallory stopped suddenly. He had almost flung aside a letter from his sister Ruth. Dear little Ruthie. But of course the baby of the family was a good 17 years old now. He opened the letter at once. Dear Ned, I write to you at Mother's dictation, as her hands are quite bad today. Father thanks you very much for the splendid lap rug from London. The French liniment has helped my hands— Mother's, very nicely, though more in the knees than the hands. We all miss you much in Lewis, though we know you are busy on your great affairs of the Royal Society. We read aloud each of your American adventures, as they are written by Mr. Disraeli in Family Museum. Agatha asks, will you please, please get her Mr. Disraeli's autograph, as her favourite novel is his Tancred. But our great news is that our dear Brian is back from Bombay, safely with us this very day, June 17th. And he has brought with him our dear brother-to-be, Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings, also of the Sussex Artillery, who asked our Madeline to wait for him, and of course she did. Now they are to be married, and Mother wants you to know particularly that it will not be in a church, but a civil ceremony with the J.P. Mr. Witherspoon in Lewis City Hall. Will you attend June 29th as Father gives away almost his last bride? I did not want to write that, but Mother made me. All our love, Ruth Mallory, Miss.